Welcome to Bent on Education Podcast, a podcast focusing on evidence-based review of physiology, pharmacology, pathophysiology, and other anesthesia-related topics. I'll discuss being a clinical preceptor, a mentor, and a leader. This podcast is by CRNA for SRNAs and others seeking to build their basic knowledge base. So let's get bent on education. Been a while. We have been so busy at the university doing a couple things, interviewing. There's just been a lot going on, but nevertheless to say, today's episode will be on propofol as promised. So propofol, the chemical name is 2,6-diisopropophenol. Sometimes I do ask that on test questions and my students are like, okay, we know this one already. You've been prepping us for this all semester. Anyway, it's probably one of the most widely recognized of the anesthetics that we use to induce anesthesia. Some people have referred to it as milk of amnesia just because of the color. It's the one agent that we use that is white. And our colleagues in intensive care units, in emergency departments, utilize propofol as well for conscious sedation in the ICUs. Obviously, some of you who have worked in those areas, and if you're a new nurse and you haven't seen it yet, you will, they will use a propofol infusion specifically for patients that are ventilated so that they're not, you know, agitated and things like that, and they don't dislodge their endotracheal tube. In interventional radiology departments for certain procedures, upper and lower endoscopies, propofol is a great drug to use for that, and we'll talk about all the reasons why. Let's discuss some of the physiochemical characteristics of propofol. These are the things that separates it from other IV anesthetics. One, it's insoluble in aqueous solutions, and so you'll see that it's an emulsion, like a lipid emulsion. It contains 10% soybean, 2.25% glycerol, and 1.2% lecithin, which is a major component in the egg yolk. So you'll see people who have like an allergy to eggs, and it's completely avoided in those individuals in some instances. Most times, patients have a allergy to the egg white, and therefore it's not that co-contamination with propofol, although you'll see providers, they do decide that they're not going to give patients with an egg allergy propofol. That's fine too. Better to err on the side of safety. Because the types of propofol or type of propofol that we use supports bacterial growth, not a good thing. That's fine. You will hear that, you know, you make sure you wipe off the top of the bottle. Make sure that you draw it up and only utilize it for the next 6 hours after you draw it up. You want to use pretty good sterile technique, is basically the bottom line. Propofol, because the emulsion contains egg yolk, again, that lecithin, susceptible patients might experience an allergic reaction. But again, current research and evidence is showing that it's the egg white that most people are allergic to. When we look at the pharmacokinetic properties, propofol is metabolized in the liver and excreted in the kidneys. That's a lot of the drugs that we utilize, or I should say a lot of the medication, if I'm using my anesthesia words, a lot of the medication that we use in anesthesia work in that way. The lungs, so interestingly enough, the lungs actually play a major role in the extrahepatic metabolism and may account for approximately 30% of a bolus dose of propofol, or the elimination of 30% of a bolus dose of propofol. That's one of those facts or one of those ideas that I had zero idea when I was in nursing school, of course, but when I worked in intensive care unit, like, who would think that? It wasn't inhaled, so why would it do that? Very good question. The rapid plasma clearance of propofol explains more about the complete recovery from propofol without that hangover effect. Remember when we were talking about barbiturates and thiopental, that patients had like a hangover effect. There was, you know, don't operate heavy equipment. You still shouldn't operate heavy equipment when you've been under the influence of propofol. But the reason that that came into vogue was more so because of the barbiturates that were used. When you wake up, and this is all, again, the pharmacokinetics of the medication, the wake up after an induction dose typically occurs within 8 to 10 minutes. We can talk about infusions and things like that, which we will talk about, because your wake up is going to be a little bit different if you're using an infusion of propofol. But just keep in mind, you give an induction dose of propofol, typically within 8 to 10 minutes, the patient would be available to wake up. This is not always what happens, of course, because you have surgery and things that happen in between the induction and the wake up, but just know that that's the profile of the medication. If you were giving a continuous intravenous infusion of propofol, one of the things that should come to mind to you is the context-sensitive halftime. What this does, or what that phenomenon is that it describes the elimination halftime after a continuous infusion as a function of the duration of your infusion. In other words, if you're infusing propofol, and let's say you've infused it for 3 or 4 hours, you are not going to expect the patient to wake up within that 8 to 10 minutes, but there is a time frame of which propofol will be eliminated after you have an infusion going for your patient. Even though the wake up is potentially not going to happen within that 8 to 10 minute time frame, just consider that even after a prolonged infusion, the recovery still remains rather prompt. I've had patients in the OR that, you know, after an 8 hour or 6 hour spinal fusion, for example, we turn our propofol infusion off, and it takes, roughly 20, perhaps 30 minutes before the patient is ready to be extubated in the operating room. Again, think context sensitive halftime when we think about any of our infusion medications. As usual, we'll talk about the pharmacodynamics of the medication. The presumed mechanism of action of propofol is through the potentiation of the chloride current mediated channels through your GABA-A receptor complex. This seems to be where a lot of our medications work, right? When we're looking at the brain and the central nervous system and how it responds to propofol, you have to know that it predominantly and primarily acts as a hypnotic medication. It does not have any analgesic properties. So if you have a patient that you're giving propofol to and they're having a fairly painful procedure, you need to make sure that you give your patient an analgesic. Otherwise, they're going to wake up in pain. The nice thing about propofol when we're looking at it, again, from a central nervous system perspective, is that it does decrease your cerebral metabolic rate of oxygen, and it decreases your cerebral blood flow as well. So those two things combined results in a decrease in the intracranial pressure as well as the intraocular pressure. When we look at the magnitude of these changes, it's pretty comparable to those changes that are produced by thiopental. So even though propofol can produce a desired decrease in ICP and again reduction in your cerebral blood flow, there is a decrease in a patient's mean arterial pressure, right? Because what propofol does is it causes peripheral vasodilation. So you want to be very careful, specifically if you're using it for a patient, a neuro patient. It does and can decrease your cerebral perfusion pressure pretty critically. Another thing about propofol is that it is a neuroprotective agent, specifically during focal ischemia. And its neuroprotectivity, I hope that's a word because that's the one I'm using. Its neuroprotectivity is about the same extent as that of thiopental. If you give large doses of propofol, It does produce burst suppression in an electroencephalogram or an EEG. What does burst suppression mean? For, you know, lack of better words, burst suppression is when the brain has a delay from the time of stimulation to firing. So that patient would be considered in burst suppression. If you run into any of my students at all, especially those who are in, I mean, all of them, because by now my first years have heard the story as well, I believe, ask them about my clinical experience with a patient giving a large dose of propofol and the patient being in burst suppression for a little while. Also to note, when we're talking about propofol from a neurological or central nervous system status, it can produce excitatory effects such as twitching, some spontaneous movement. You might see that. And it's one of those properties of propofol that people experience whether they're doing conscious sedation, whether they're doing an induction of general anesthesia. Although, and this is one thing that any nurse or, you know, someone in healthcare needs to know if you're giving this medication, is that even though these effects can look a lot like seizure activity, propofol is actually an anticonvulsant, so it's safely administered to patients with seizure disorders. You'll see this. We had a patient a couple years back that these excitatory movements, crazy enough, lasted throughout the PACU experience of this patient. I'm going to see if I can find an article in reference to this, because it's very intriguing to see this. And, you know, people think like this patient's having a seizure, and that's actually not what's happening. When we look at propofol from a cardiovascular standpoint, it does produce large decreases in your systemic arterial blood pressure, more than almost any other drug that we give or any other medication that we give for the induction of anesthesia. It can produce profound vasodilation, whereas its direct myocardial depressant effect is really not clear. So people are still looking at that and looking what research and evidence shows about its direct myocardial depressant effect. Vasodilation, though, does occur both in the arterial and the venous circulation, and what you're going to see is a big reduction in a patient's preload and the patient's afterload. So if a patient has significant cardiac disease, it's one of those medications that you may want to give incrementally so that you don't produce an effect for the patient that's detrimental to their cardiovascular standpoint. When we look at the systemic blood pressure, it's more pronounced in the elderly. So they're going to have, that population of patients will have a bigger drop in their blood pressure, specifically their systemic blood pressure, than any other population of patient. It is more profound, even more profound, when there is a reduction in the intravascular volume. Why would there be a reduction in intravascular volume, you might ask? For a lot of reasons. Trauma, so patient's bleeding. In anesthesia, a patient has fasted and or did like a bowel prep for, you know, an upper or lower endoscopy. You might see a significant decrease in their blood pressure when you give an induction dose of propofol. Another thing that propofol does from a cardiovascular standpoint is that it inhibits the normal baroreflex response and produces only a small increase in heart rate. So it can thus further exacerbate this hypotensive effect when a patient is hypovolemic. Profound bradycardia, even asystole, has been seen when you administer propofol to healthy patients. So be very careful. This medication doesn't go without its, you know, I don't want to say faults, but without its side effects. So what do people do? They may give an anticholinergic effect, medication like glycopyrrolate or atropine, but you just don't know which patients you're going to experience this with. So I always say to my students, less is more. I heard that when I was in school, and I take that with me. You can always give more of a medication, but you cannot take away what you've already given. Let's talk about some of the respiratory effects of propofol. It is a respiratory depressant, so if you give an induction dose or you give a decent dose of propofol, you will see that your patient will become apneic. When you are giving propofol as an infusion and your patient is spontaneously breathing, a maintenance infusion will reduce, let's say, the patient's minute ventilation. And how is that minute ventilation decreased? Because we're decreasing the patient's tidal volume and their respiratory rate, but you still would see a continuously, spontaneously ventilating patient. So the nice thing is if you're giving a propofol infusion for what we call a total IV anesthetic, I mean, you can go up to, as you know, 250 mics per kilogram per minute and still have your patient spontaneously breathing. Propofol is, you know, when we look at the ventilatory response to hypoxia or hypercapnia, it's reduced as well. And it does cause a greater reduction in the airway reflexes than thiopental does. So it makes it a nice agent for if you need to instrument the airway with placing a laryngeal mask airway, or if you're placing an endotracheal tube in your patient. So I can give a dose of propofol, not give a neuromuscular blocking agent, and intubate the patient safely. You know, you just have to know when's the right time. Is your patient apneic? You can do it when your patient is spontaneously breathing. This takes a little bit more skill and preparation because you don't want to tap the vocal cords and potentially have your patient experience a laryngospasm. When we compare thiopental, propofol decreases the incidence of wheezing after induction of anesthesia and tracheal intubation in both the healthy patient and the asthmatic patient. So you can see the profile of the medication. It is good for various patient populations. What are some of the other effects of propofol for our patients, or some of the other benefits? Unlike many of our other anesthetic agents, so you've heard, you know, people wake up from anesthesia, they have nausea, they have vomiting, and it's just this awful thing that's going on in PACU. There have been studies that said that patients have said, I'd rather have pain than nausea or vomiting. I probably can attest to that as well. But the nice thing about propofol is that propofol does have some antiemetic properties. So there are patients that, you know, you feel like you're giving them a little bit more protection along with your other agents that you might use for postoperative nausea and vomiting. What you do want to consider, specifically for those of you who work in an intensive care unit, when you're looking at an infusion of propofol over a long period of time, you need to be cognizant that propofol infusion syndrome can happen. So if you have a patient that's been on propofol for couple of hours, even couple of days, and they just all of a sudden become tachycardic, you may want to monitor for that because the patient may at that time be experiencing a metabolic acidosis that comes along with propofol infusion syndrome. When we utilize propofol in our clinical settings and you have an awake patient, obviously, and you're ready to give them a dose of propofol, pain on injection is one of the side effects of this medication. It's a common complaint. You can, attenuate that by giving a pre-medication of an opioid or co-administering your propofol with lidocaine, for example. There are times in the OR if I'm, you know, inducing a child that has an IV already, I will give lidocaine and put a tourniquet on that limb so that it kind of gives that, you know, effect of blocking, if you will, numbing the vein so that when I give propofol, this patient won't have an intense pain on injection. Another way that you can attenuate this pain on injection is maybe using a larger IV, putting it in an antecubital space. I do pediatric anesthesia, so the likelihood that we're using larger IVs is not that great depending on the size of the patient. And using an antecubital space in a peds patient, it's really tough as well because, you know, kids like to right? They like to color bend their arms. So we try to not put IVs there. But if you're working in the adult population and you are putting in an IV and you know you need to use propofol and you kind of want to attenuate that pain on injection, the antecubital space is not a bad place to put your intravenous line. So some of our clinical uses, remember, is the induction and maintenance of anesthesia with propofol. Our IV dosing of this medication for induction is typically 2 to 2.5 milligrams per kilogram IV, and it's most commonly administered, again, to induce anesthesia to patients. When you look at increasing age, so the elderly, those patients, again, we talked about it a little bit before, who have a reduction in their cardiovascular reserve, or you've pre-medicated your patient already with a benzodiazepine or an opioid or opiate, this does reduce the required induction dose. Whereas my lovelies, so the pediatric patient, typically require a larger dose of propofol for induction. We're looking at 2.5 to 3.5 milligrams per kilo. Generally, though, if you titrate the induction dose, so instead of just giving like a large bolus dose right away and you titrate the dose, you can, again, prevent those severe hemodynamic changes that you would normally see on induction. It's a great maintenance of anesthesia, either as a part of, let's say, a balanced anesthetic regimen. So if you combine it with our volatile agents, if you're working in anesthesia, or nitrous oxide, your hypnotics, or again, your opioids or opiates, we will typically combine it with those for what I told you about before, total IV anesthetic or TEVA. When we look at, drawing labs, if you're getting in depth with your propofol infusions, you can look at therapeutic plasma concentrations for the maintenance of anesthesia. And if you were to do that, you're typically looking at roughly 3 to 8 mics per ml. But normally, you know, you're going to dose it based on the patient's physiologic status. So just keep an eye on what's going on. Be very vigilant when you're giving this medication. Propofol is very popular for sedation or conscious sedation. But when we're looking at sedation of your mechanically ventilated patient, it's a great drug. It's great for conscious sedation when you're doing procedures in an emergency room or in a treatment room. The required concentration or plasma concentration of this medication is roughly 1 to 2 mics per ml, which would normally, if you're looking at what that continuous infusion rate is, that translates to somewhere between 20 and 75 mics per kilo per minute. Keep in mind, we talked about this when we were talking about the respiratory effects of propofol, but keep in mind, because it does have pronounced respiratory depressant effects, it has a very narrow therapeutic range. And my students and I talk about therapeutic range of medication, so you don't have that safety net anymore. Remember, if you're working, now this is for specifically talking to those who are in anesthesia school and or are delivering anesthesia now, when we talk about that therapeutic index or that therapeutic window, we don't have a safety net anymore, right? Because when you're working on the units, you always have, you know, the physician or resident or fellow writes an order, that order goes to you, you look at it, you send it to pharmacy, pharmacy checks it, it comes back to you, and you give the medication. In anesthesia, we have all these medications that are just right at our fingertips. So knowing that a medication like this has a narrow therapeutic index or narrow therapeutic window, you always want to make sure that it's administered by people who are trained in airway management. Because if we obliterate the respiratory drive of a patient and our patient becomes apneic, we need to be able to manage the airway for the patient. So that's it for now for the basics of propofol, one of our favorite agents used in anesthesia. So next week, what are we going to talk about? Maybe it'll be a surprise, right? Are we going to go into our neuromuscular blocking agents, or is there another agent that I have not told you all about yet? But whatever it is we're going to talk about, you'll know because I'll give it to you. Thanks so much for listening, and as usual, get bent on education.